Welcome to the Growth Equation Podcast. We're your hosts, Brad Stahlberg
and Steve Magnus. Brad, my man, how's everything going?
Things are going. It is cold here. It feels like winter is suddenly upon us in Asheville. It's crisp. Morning dog walks, evening dog walks are cold, but I'm feeling warm today because I get to talk to you and Emil El Zamora.
Yes, yes. It is not freezing here in Houston, but I am looking forward to this conversation as well because Emil is a world-class artist. He has done some beautiful, amazing sculpting work, which you can check out on his website. We're going to dive into his creative process, how he sees the world, the importance of doing real things, which can be a physical practice or could be sculpting. All sorts of good stuff. Emil has so many good insights. I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's going to be a little bit different, but in a really, important and influential way. So that's where we're at.
That is where we're at. Bear with us. There's a little bit of feedback in Emil's microphone. You'll hear a common theme throughout the conversation is Emil lives a pretty low-tech life. He's too busy creating beautiful sculptures to know about the ins and outs of podcasting. So if the sound quality isn't what you're used to from us, hang in there. We think it is a very small price to pay for the insights in this conversation with a different than usual guest, as Steve pointed out. Before we get into the interview, we want to plug another podcast. As you all know, we here at The Growth Equation are 100% independent, member-supported on Patreon. We take no sponsorships. But we made a little trade because there's a new podcast called Reconsidering that we've absolutely loved. It's hosted by Aaron Walter, Meredith Black, and Bob Baxley. And they call it a podcast about life, which is really relevant to the things that we talk about here. In particular, they're interested in how COVID has forced so many people to reconsider their jobs, reconsider their relationships, reconsider their sources of meaning. I was on the podcast recently. I had such a great conversation with them. I went back, I listened to all the episodes, and it is the perfect complement to the kind of stuff that we talk about here at The Growth Equation. So much so that Catherine May, who wrote the book Wintering and who will be as a part of our Patreon book club, is a featured guest on Reconsidering. They've got a professor of philosophy from MIT as a Kiran Setia phenomenal episode. So just all kinds of great stuff over there. If you need another podcast in your rotation that's different than some of the other stuff out there, we think you should give Reconsidering a spin. You can listen everywhere you listen to podcasts, and you can learn more at www.reconsidering.org. Again, to be clear, we're not selling out. We're not getting paid. We genuinely think this is a great podcast and a perfect complement to the Growth EQ. So we're excited to tell you all about it. So with that, let's dive into the conversation with today's guest, the artist Emil El Zamora. Emil, great to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
Thanks so much. I'm doing great. Nice to be with you guys. It's a treat.
It's a treat for us too. As listeners know, when we do interviews on the show, we tend to be really interested in elite performers that are on a sustainable path to success that merge mind, body, spirit, science, art. Yet we've never had a material artist on the show. We've had athletes, we've had recording artists, we've had entrepreneurs. You are our first sculptor. So why don't you give us a little bit of background about your journey to making a living and having a career as a sculptor?
Well, beautiful intro, and I love how you compare. Well, I think in all walks, this effort to express oneself, whether it's through literal creativity, in my case, I say that I'm literally creative. I actually make tangible objects that are expressions of my creativity. But there's so many ways to be creative, and athletics is one of them. And there, it's sort of infinite. But in terms of visual art and sculpture, in my case, primarily sculpture, I do some 2D as well as well, mostly 3D, but some painting. And now I'm kind of exploring 2.5 dimensions, which is an interesting subject too. But in terms of how I got here and how I started, I kind of come from a family of artists. My mother, my grandmother, my aunt, they were all working artists, and sort of felt like the family business in a way. Even though I initially was a little bit more practical, or I wanted more or less a more stable job as a youth, being an illustrator or a medical illustrator or something of that nature, and comic books when I was younger. In college, I had really great professors and mentors that kind of redirected me toward fine art and kind of back to my roots of that sort of less practical form of expression. And then when I graduated college, I ended up in New York and worked at a foundry for a couple of years to kind of really hone my skills and learn about how to make three-dimensional works without limitation, or with much far fewer limitations. And then I made a body of work when I was there in my early 20s, mid-20s, and started showing thereafter and haven't stopped. So I'm still at it 20 years in, I guess.
Love it. So I you know, you mentioned something in there, Emil, that I want to kind of dive into. Is you said you were kind of pushing or leaning towards something more stable, right? And then you get in college, you get some professors, some mentors. What was it like moving away from that path of future stability towards one that allows you to express, but also has like this inherent risk involved and uncertainty because of just the line of work you do?
That's a great question. And I think it was part of learning the broader context of where art can exist, and in this case, visual art. The more I learned about art history and the more I learned about the contemporary context, because my family were kind of weren't really that into the cutting edge contemporary art scene. They were more their own thing with a broad emphasis on classics and a broader spectrum of art rather than the leading edge of what was happening now, or say the New York City art scene. Where I had an aunt that was involved in the New York City art scene, and my uncle, and they were really, I guess, more aware of the career aspect of a fine art, I guess, career, for lack of a better description. Whereas my mom and my aunt, my grandmother were more bohemian and a little bit more outsider, if you will. So for me, the whole prospect seemed a little too far out to be that outsider. And then in college, I learned a little bit more about what my aunt and uncle had been doing. They both died way too young, in their 20s and 40s. But I always knew about their New York art career. And in college, I learned quite a bit more about contemporary art and just, like I said, the broader context of that sort of expression. And I thought, you know what? This is where it matters. And it's not about being able to predict how safe it's going to be. You just have to go all in and trust that it'll work out. And I attribute some of that to my good mentorship and the teachers I had at Florida State in Tallahassee, where I went to school. And it just sort of shifted. I had this feeling that I needed to be more immersed in the art historical narrative as opposed to a more practical graphic design or illustration or, you know, there's so many ways to apply your draftsmanship or your creativity, but I think the broader or the more narrow focus of high art or fine art or vision, like that intention is much more specific. And that was something I learned more about in school. And so I sort of dove in headfirst when I came to New York, knowing that that's what that direction would mean.
We're going to bounce around a bit. So I'm going to move from the past to the present. Where does your inspiration for your work come from? I am super fortunate. I own two pieces of yours. And, you know, they say that art has a truth that is not rational. It makes you feel. It's like a deeper truth. And your work, to me, just captures elements of the human spirit, whether it's defeat, whether it's a feeling of just having given everything, whether it's rising up. How do these pieces come to you?
It's a good question. It's almost like, well, the art practice for me and sculpture in particular, I've always been very physical and not necessarily athletic. I was not really a good athlete, but I liked running and I liked cycling, and I did do some team sports, even though it wasn't my natural inclination. The physicality of sculpture was really attractive to me. And I think tied to that is the intense feeling that can be expressed through not so much an image, like a painting is an image of something, but a sculpture is the embodiment or the effigy of what could possibly actual, you know, it's an actual manifestation of this feeling and expressivity. So I think the inspiration is to kind of create these totems that can embody that emotion. And the emotions are open to interpretation. Everybody brings their own kind of narrative and history and emotional ecosystem to what it is that is being made. And it's not for everyone, but I think I do like the idea of, I'm a bit of a populist in that I don't want my work to have a code that has to be unpacked to understand it through an artist statement or through an obscure contemporary kind of, and a lot of conceptual art, you really have to decode it to start accessing what might become an emotion. But for me, I love that initial impact of the whole spectrum of human emotion. And it seems to lean toward intense and maybe dramatic with my work.
Yeah. There's a piece that I'm going to describe in the show notes for listeners. We'll link to an image of it. And I have a miniature of this sculpture that you made. And it's a figure, a human, just kind of like on the ground, arms out, leaning over at the hips, not praying, not just like spent. And it was really the first piece of artwork that I had such a visceral experience to. I saw it at my grandmother's house when I was probably like 19. And something about it just, I was just getting into philosophy and reading and what does it mean to have a meaningful life. And something about that piece just spoke to me in such a profound way of like this person that had just like emptied out everything. And in any context, it could be a runner that just won their first medal, a parent that just gave birth to a child, a creative that just had work. So that's how I interpreted it. I'm curious, when you're first coming up with that idea and creating that sculpture, what are you thinking? What's going through your mind?
Yeah, so that particular sculpture, I titled it Abrazo, which in Spanish means embrace. And it was for a specific site-specific commission that was pretty broad. And it went to my hometown. My former employer commissioned me to make a sculpture that honored the island and the people that were lucky enough to grow up on the island, such as myself and his grandchildren. So it was a very personal inquiry from this particular patron. And I just thought, well, what about having grown up on this island and on the Gulf Coast of Florida, what meant the most to me? And I just felt that the land itself and the beach and the surf and just nestling oneself in that landscape to me felt right. And to express that almost larger than life, I made this wingspan. The person has a 10.5-foot wingspan and they're kind of life size. So it's a sort of an exaggerated outsized embrace of the land beneath them. But I love your interpretation of where you took it. It's just, it's beautiful. And that's the beauty of making these things that hopefully are charged with human emotion, that human emotion can be read differently through different people. And in a way it was very cathartic for me to make that piece because it was an embrace and a recognition of the support and the love that I was lucky enough to have from that community and from that landscape, and going to the beach every day as a child, young adult, that formed me for sure. And so the piece for me was absolutely about reverie and humility, humbling oneself to the grandeur and beauty of the world.
That's beautiful. I love it. Let me ask you, Emil, about something that Brad and I have wrestled with. And I think some of your answers here have kind of hinted at this. You mentioned the physicality of like running and cycling and then bringing that into sculpture. With the world seeming a little bit chaotic, I think it's Brad and I both have this idea, this theory that it's more important now than ever to do real things.
Yes.
And like whether that real thing is running where you spend all your, you know, you just get exhausted, but you're moving in a reality, or that real thing is creating something, a sculpture out of before what was just pieces and parts. I'm wondering if like just if you can riff off of that and give us your thoughts on that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's such an interesting subject for me because I do, well, I'd say about 80% of the work that I make is analog or material in the studio. And then I have an office with a computer, and I've been in recent years doing more and more VR sculpting or sculpting on the computer. And they're two very different worlds. One is much more cerebral, less physical. You actually get a little bit office chairy, like, you know, when you need to get out there and run up the hill or something like that to sort of have a contrast to this immersive digital world. It's almost, I call it, it's like a collective imagination that we're manifesting. And it's just another way that we're able to create the world in our own image. It's not to get too esoteric or like spiritual like that, but I do feel like humanity is committed to recreating our own biology in a way, not consciously, but I mean, almost literally with the neural network and the kind of wiring up the electricity, the energy systems, the flow with materials and commerce. And it's kind of fascinating how we're creating this superorganism. And so I think it's important, as in normal life, I guess to call it that, you can't just sit at your office all day. Otherwise it's detrimental. So you have to have this balance between some sort of tie to our physicality. And I think going forward, part of what's so weird about the world right now is I think we have an imbalance because of the novelty of all this electric kind of entertainment and information. We're still sort of figuring out how to strike a balance between what it has to offer and what's still healthy for us to participate in physically. IRL, in real life, I learned that recently. I'm like, really? That's a thing? Which, unfortunately, that is a thing, but IRL is real. And now with the Meta thing, people talking about, you know, Facebook turning to Meta, which is just yet another example of this collective imagination just trying to seep its way into the IRL. But I love sculpture. I got into it because it felt much more physical. And for me, it's still a big part of why I do it. Even though I'm 46 now and starting to feel the wear and tear of some of the, you know, any physical work will start to break you down a little bit. That's why I'm trying to do more sustainable exercises and workouts with my wife. And we're trying to put more of an emphasis on physical well-being, not just toil, but actual care and maintenance and that sort of thing. But yeah, to kind of wrap that up, I do think we're learning collectively, we're really having to learn what it means to be immersed in that collective imagination so much time and without losing our minds. And maybe part of the key is to remember our bodies and the need to maintain them properly while we immerse ourselves in that other dimension.
So before Steve does what Steve does, which is ask you questions about how you prepare for the physicality of your job, it just occurred to me that a lot of listeners here are probably not veterans of the art world. And my guess is they're curious, how do you make a living as an artist? Like, you are a professional artist. How does that work? What are the mechanics of it?
Yeah, I think every artist will have a different story to an extent. And it also depends on your intention. Like I said, you could be an artist and draw comic books, and that's a very specific market and use of your skills. But in my case, my intention is to make fine art and try to insert it into that art historical narrative. But what I mean by that is you're trying to aim at the heart of that creativity that has sort of sustained this continued conversation that we've had from since we were carving fertility goddesses 30,000 years ago or whatever they are. I mean, it's in theory that's what they are, but so that said, yeah, my intention is to somehow contribute to that dialogue, and in that it has its own set of commercial dilemmas, and that they don't like to present it as commerce. It has to be seen as untainted by the market. But at the same time, at the highest levels, it's all about commerce. So you have this paradox in the art world. And what I mean by the art world is sort of the fine art galleries that are attempting to contribute to that same dialogue, as opposed to some of the more commercial galleries that are more about, I guess you could say, interior design or decorative art. And there is a distinction there. And it's challenging to try to position yourself to be viewed in that context, because it's a very coveted and restrictive arena, this what I'm describing. And an interesting thing that happened recently was NFTs and Beeple, and this $70 million NFT digital art that sold was this kind of dialogue between Beeple and one of the top blue chip artists at one of the top galleries. And you just hear them kind of go at it in terms of what is art and who gets to call it art. But now all of a sudden this outsider artist is the third most expensive living artist right now. So it kind of turned the whole thing on its head. What is fine art? And so it's an interesting dialogue that's happening at the moment with the direction of art and digital art, and how open is it? How broad of a market can it be? But for me, kind of circling back to on a personal level, it's really about connections, personal connections to galleries and to previous collectors that have expressed interest in my work, and just kind of maintaining those relationships and ultimately making your best work and seeing what happens. That's kind of been my mantra from the beginning.
But so to relate it to our world of book publishing, is it, and I just want to get clear on like the supply chain, if you will, or their mechanics, someone will either commission something from you. So they'll go to you and say, Emil, I want a piece for this space, or I have this idea in mind. Or you'll create something and then go to a gallery and sell it to the gallery, or they'll sell it and then take some commission. So there's like a,
right.
There's a
yeah.
push and a pull element. Is that right?
Yeah. So the nuts and bolts of the gallery relationship is they'll consign something, and when they sell it, it's a 50-50 split. Unless there's expensive production costs and you can kind of negotiate to maybe 60-40 or something like that, or production off the top. So in that sense, it can be very practical. And that's, I'd say, the majority of my interaction occasionally there will be a commission or something like that that arises where there'll be a site-specific location. And in that instance, I'm very restrictive of what I'm willing to take on. It has to be, okay, I'm aware of the space. What do I want to make? Do you like it? Okay, we can move forward. As opposed to ordering up something specifically. And I kind of gave up on a lot of public artworks because there's so many limitations in terms of what you're able to do. And I just kind of work with galleries and private collections because they're much more, much less committee oriented. And is it safe enough, or does it communicate the right message for a broad audience? And so there's the most creative freedom when I just make I make what I want in the studio and then see which gallery responds to it and who wants to show it. Or if all of them do, then that's great. But, mostly galleries and sometimes these site-specific commissions.
So you mentioned right there that, like, freedom to express, right? Because it in your world, even in our world of writing, it can be very tempting to just be like, okay, I'm going to go do this because the publisher or the public, whatever, want this thing done. But what I'm hearing from you is like that freedom to express, to figure out what you want to create is sitting first and foremost, and you kind of craft your vision and then you go look for where it fits versus the other way around.
Is yeah, right? Definitely. Absolutely. I think, I kind of describe it as there's the market on the far left or right, whichever, and then there's the studio on the opposite end. And then there's a lot of gray area in between. And the gray area is like an insulation buffer for me. When I'm in the studio, it's all about just exploring and creativity and finding out what it is I want to do. And then on the other end, there's the market aspect of it. Like, how is this going to turn into money? And the more space between how is this turning into money and what am I doing in the studio, the better. And that I'm not really thinking about, will this sell or does this have the potential to sell when I'm making it? Because there's enough room between stuff that I've already made and things that are already happening from previous efforts to sustain the current exploration. So the more space I can create between my time in the studio and dealing with the challenges of selling the work, the better.
I love that. That's such a brilliant metaphor, because it's so like that. It's like any aspect, whenever the selling starts intruding on the creating, it impacts and impedes. Like,
yeah, it's that. Almost quantum. It's like observing the study affects the study. And it absolutely, I would say that's a perfectly accurate description of, and I can kind of, I have a little spidey sense or whatever that goes off when there's a overlap or an intrusion, and I just kind of freak out, and I know that it's not right, and I leave, or I take a break, or I completely reevaluate, or I totally stall out.
Yeah. So
go ahead.
This reminds me a little, there was this fascinating essay in The Atlantic by a writer named Derek Thompson that Steve and I immediately hopped on the phone after we both read it and talked about, where he said that there, in his opinion, has been an enormous lack of creativity and invention over the last couple of decades because everything is now so responsive to real-time metrics. So instead of taking a big swing at a new movie, you make a sequel and then you make, you know, Terminator 9. Instead of doing some art that could really be original, you take something that's already worked and you do permutations of it. So what you're saying completely echoes that. And once you're in that orbit, I mean, we know from our work writing, it's extremely hard not to have that kind of feedback like encroach upon your brain, because your brain is super contextual. So creating like some pretty rigid boundaries and barriers between where the creativity comes from in the work versus everything that's out there, I think is a hard practice and an important one.
Yeah, well said. I agree. I think It's something I started to become very aware of early on. Really needing to buffer what happens to the work once it's finished and where the work, the new work comes from. And it's not to say that you're completely immune to influences of your previous successes. I don't want to sound like I'm perfect, but I think I'm also benefited from having what I might call ADHD or just getting bored really quickly. And if I find myself tempted to repeat anything, it's excruciating. It's actually physically painful. And so I'll just turn it over and start something different, irrational and complicated and likely not to sell. And I think it's the spirit of innovation, really. You don't want to get comfortable or in too much of a groove, because I mean, that's the end of it. So my intuition has been to go in the other direction enough to keep it interesting.
So I love that idea. And I've said that a lot, but I do. So it's almost like you're using the feedback of like boredom, of comfort, as like a signal that tells you like, this isn't the place I want to be in for creativity. Like I've got to shift and change.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, I guess the more I've worked and the more I'm familiar with my creative process, it's almost, like the tingling happens before I'm even tempted to do anything. It's like I find myself a little bit more halted, it's not procrastinating, it's just sitting on things longer because I want to make sure that it feels right before I invest the time and energy. Because, you know, the older you get, the more you realize you don't have all the time in the world to do some of these minor things that don't entirely hit the marks, all the markers of, yes, this is worth doing. And one of the easiest things to weed out is, does this feel redundant? And by redundant, I mean, is it too close to what you already know, rather than truly exploring and finding something that's going to fill your sails or put you on the edge and make you horrified at yourself.
So let's talk. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Emil.
No. Which is, I think, part of the motivation is to just constantly try to freak yourself out. And I don't know. It's maybe that's a personality thing, but I've always looked to try to upend my own satisfaction or comfort or et cetera.
I mean, I think that's when we first really hit it off, is we featured you in Peak Performance in the section on meaning and purpose. And we were so thrilled that then you came back to us and said, I love the book. And what I'm hearing you describe is like what we would call stress plus rest equals growth. Like, you just, if you want to keep evolving and growing, you always have to be putting yourself outside of your comfort zone.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I love that. It's such a, that book had so many brilliant insights into that process. And I don't think that it's something that has been clearly articulated or I mean, it should be curriculum, you know, in my opinion.
Well, teachers, librarians, if you're listening.
Yeah. Right. It's so valuable, especially to kind of get people to tap into what creativity is and what rigor is. But not overdoing, you know, but to balance it, because I think it's also easy to burn out. And I too have been a victim of my own burnout. And, you know, I tend to make slightly different works when I hit burnout mode that are a little bit more gentle, more pliable, or less physically intensive. And now I think I'm almost facing I don't know if it's the pandemic or if it's midlife stuff, but I wouldn't say it's burnout as much as it is intense reevaluation of my workflow, because I find it to not be that productive to have too many irons in the fire, which has typically been my, and that's part of the gray areas. I think I make up for that market studio split by just having quantity of things in progress, works in progress everywhere, from 3 inches to 12 feet tall. You know, they're just all over the place. And that's part of why I don't really always know what's going to end up happening in the market, because I have no clue what's happening even right now in front of me. So it's almost creating too much gray area, which I've found to be, maybe I need to be a little bit more disciplined about not relying on that sort of diversity in the studio for the sake of buffering me and protecting me from the market the intense pressure from the market, or from just making a living at it. So I think somewhere is a balance. I don't have to spread it out so much. I can be a little bit more deliberate, and I'm reassessing my whole workflow at this point to try to be better at that.
So let's dive into the details a little bit about your workflow. And one thing I'm curious about is, you just said you have a ton of irons in the fire. Like, what does that look like on a day-to-day basis where you have all these different projects going on? Like, how do you decide what to work on? And then more important, like, how do you balance or switch between them?
Well, the nice thing about sculpture is that it is time, very much time related. Everything has its time and place. So oftentimes if I'm starting a piece, I'll have to walk away from it. And so that's an easy, because I can't work on it anymore. It has to dry, or it has to cure, or something like that. So that very physical aspect is part of what factors into that. So I have multiple pieces going, because oftentimes I can't just work on one piece and do it consistently. So I say time is a medium, and you have to factor it in and work with it. And I love that part of it. And even leaving pieces outside for a couple of years to expose them to the elements and bringing them back in, that's also something that I've explored recently. But I think it's largely intuitive and kind of impulsive. And I think that's the ADD part. Not to self-diagnose, but I think there's probably something to that. And it might be not that, because I'm very good at focusing for long periods of time, but in my own way, and with a lot of different things to distract me from one thing to the next. And so I think that part of it becomes very intuitive and material, and also occasionally deadlines. If I have a show or an art fair or a specific timeline that I have to work within, then that factors in as well.
So do you have any children?
I have a stepdaughter, and she's 24. She graduated college right at the beginning of the pandemic, and not beginning. Yeah. 2 months into the pandemic was her last class.
And so she graduated. Older. Yeah. What I was going to ask, because I have a 3.5-year-old, I'm a little younger than you, but so children are the prime example of, like, you know, little Zen masters that will come in the middle of anything you're doing and take you out of it. But I have a similar brain. I've worked with Steve long enough to know that he does too, where it can be all over the place. But then if you're locked in on something, like, you're locked in, you know, I haven't changed, like, certain light bulbs or replaced, like, a wrist strap on a watch until I'm done with a book project, because, like, I can't take 2 minutes of brain activity to do that. I'm locked in. How have you learned to manage that? Or maybe you haven't, when you do have other things in your life, whether it's a relationship or even just, like, the administrative bullshit parts of your job, or, like, the promotion, all that other stuff. Have you figured out a good system for you so it doesn't feel like you're constantly getting that creativity in the space infringed upon?
Right. No, it's a good question. I think I refer to it as artistic fitness in a way. And it may have come from our talks previously from your Peak Performance book, but it's super important to have that momentum and to not have it be too interrupted. And in a way, if you want to stay fit, you have to just keep working out. You have to keep pushing yourself. And so I think the same applies in the studio. That kind of creativity comes from a certain level of commitment, time, fitness. And so, yeah, life does get in the way, as it does get in the way of working out as much as you want to. But I'm super fortunate in that my wife basically takes care of an enormous amount of the administrative stuff, pretty much all of it. And she's also active in mold making and in the studio with projects from time to time as well. There's a lot of support coming from there, and that definitely helps. It used to be that, like in my early days, I think I would feel more of an urgency to get in the studio and to be productive. And then I think the more I became immersed in my own little, well, to use that word again, labyrinth. It's almost, it's luckily for me, it just seems kind of seamless. And part of that is having a studio in the backyard and being able to just flow from work to raking, to snow, shoveling snow, to mowing the lawn, to whatever needs doing. It's almost like a nice antidote to being in the studio. So, and, you know, breaking for lunch or dinner and watching something at night, it's all welcome at this point because I do feel like I get so much time in the studio. So it seems pretty on cruise control in a way, that kind of dilemma. Whereas I used to have more of that dilemma. It just feels sort of well taken care of now. And again, a big part of that is not having to deal with a lot of the business management parts because Annie takes care of it. It's incredible.
So let me ask you this, Emil. Let's dive into, you know, we've kind of danced around this creativity. And I know long ago when we talked before peak performance, you had some great insight on almost like giving yourself the best chance to be in this creative mode by having the right environment around you. And I'm wondering if you could, you know, tell our audience a little bit on how do you get to that space in your studio where you can do good work?
Yeah, I think part of it is being free from, for me, the best feeling is to wake up and feel like I don't have a lot of obligations, like, or plans, or for a blank day is optimum. But if I know I have an 11 o'clock appointment or something, that it definitely interrupts my ability to just get into a spontaneous workflow. And so trying to protect and insulate myself from too many responsibilities or obligations is key to maintain that momentum. And that's why it's hard to do. People say, well, you know, isn't it weird to try to make a living out of making art? Shouldn't art not be tied to the market? And I say, well, that'd be great if you had a trust fund, but if you kind of have to make a living at it, you have to resolve that. And part of the resolution is feeling like you have the environment set and setting. Yeah. Well, I think it is kind of, it's a bit psychedelic, all of it, not to go esoteric or anything, but I did at one point when I was 16, way too many mushrooms in one sitting with my brother. It kind of altered everything, and it took me years to process it, but it did teach me this really interesting alternate relationship to time. And so I think I'm sensitive to the influences that do either serve or hinder the creative process. And for me, it's super important to have a studio in the same spot as where I lived. I couldn't commute because a commute to me would immediately be a disruption. And once I arrived, and I've had that in the past, a studio that was like 10 minutes away, and I just never got into a groove. I was there for a year and a half, and I never felt like things started to flow. And it wasn't until I had a studio in the backyard, and even though it was 200 square feet, it was tiny. In the 10 years that I had that tiny studio, everything just kind of worked because it felt seamless and easy and natural and not disrupted by anything. And also being surrounded by trees and the water out front. Yeah, I think if I were to wrap it up, I think it may sound selfish or self-focused. And I think that's part of the dilemma of a lot of creatives is that they just need to invest a lot of time in themselves, both to understand what's going on and what's important and what matters to themselves. I've done a pretty good job of protecting my time and crafting each day to have as few intrusions or interruptions as possible to be able to build that momentum. And I think the setting is really important to that. Having a studio in the right location, if you're enriched by a city, well, then that can work. But I know for me, a city would be very distracting. Being in the wooded area for me is kind of perfect. I like to look at the trees and see the animals and stuff like that. I think that immediately puts me into a lot of it's kind of beyond my understanding too. I sometimes wonder how different would it be to have a studio in a different location. I've gotten so used to this one. I've been here for almost 20 years. So some of these things are out of our conscious mind too.
Yeah. It reminds me, there was a book that came out earlier this year called The Extended Mind. We had an earlier podcast episode about it too, where the writer Annie Murphy Paul basically says that we think of the mind and the brain is the same thing inside our head, but the mind is actually so contextual. So what her book would argue is that if you were in a different studio, the work would be completely different.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's neat to think about that too. I think in so many contexts beyond just obviously art and creativity, but just as a way to change things up when you're stuck or if things aren't going a certain way or you're not happy with them, changing your environment can be really powerful.
Definitely. And that's part of what I'm trying to do in the studio. It's not so much changing the surroundings, but it's changing the activity inside the studio to kind of pare it down and be more deliberate in what I take on.
So last question, and then we'll wrap up here. You've alluded to the fact that the work can be pretty physical at times. So as you've aged, I'm curious, has it reduced your capacity to spend time in the studio? I know you said that you're starting to focus a little bit more, not just on pushing, but on recovering and taking care of your body. Could you just briefly kind of tell us about the physicality of the work and how you try to do it in a way that's sustainable as you age?
Yeah, for sure. I think early days, I didn't think twice about just going full on and lifting heavy things and as youth is capable of. And then one day I felt something weird happen and it was in my lower back. And I thought, oh, I guess that's what people talk about. Because you'd hear people say, oh, mind your back or lift with your leg. And you think, yeah, whatever. I got this. And then the knife goes in and you feel something and it never goes away completely. You always are aware that you could return there with any twist or misstep. So with enough of these kinds of injuries, be it in my upper back or my shoulder or my lower back, I'm definitely more cautious in my approach and more aware of the fact that I have to do just maintenance type things that build strength and not just rely on the physicality of sculpting, which does burn a lot of calories, but actually doing restorative and strengthening exercises. So I'd say in the last year or so, I've gotten much more serious about just maintaining, especially my upper body, because my legs, I'd always run up the hill to kind of blow off steam or that was easy. And luckily there's about a quarter of a mile hill right outside the studio that I just sprint up it. And sometimes I'll do suicides up it. And it's cathartic and it's great, but it's not necessarily restorative for my shoulder or my back and things like that. So lately I've been doing more deliberate strengthening exercises. And I think that's part of striking a balance between being able to work smarter and longer, even though it seems like you're redirecting energy and attention to something else. And I think that's wisdom. As you age, you start realizing, oh, I'm actually more productive if I redirect my energy elsewhere to then bring it back with greater effect to the studio.
I love it. Thanks so much, Emil. Just to wrap up, I you know, you're deeply insightful. You gave a lot of actual very good practical takeaways, and I've just really enjoyed this conversation and have a slew of notes over here.
Cool.
But I just want to thank you, but then I want to leave you one spot. If you know, for our audience, you've read our work, you've been a longtime supporter, all of that stuff, you've been generous with your time. What message would you like to leave with our audience? You know, something that is impactful for you, or something that you know, might make a difference.
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, I think we are, as humans, fundamentally creative beings. We thrive on expressing ourselves within a small community or a broader community, and whatever that expression, whatever form that takes, I think it's important to cultivate the space where you can access it and tune out a lot of the noise that is so tempting, especially this sort of digital opium that we scroll through every day. And whether it's, you know, Twitter or with words or Instagram with images, it's so tempting to get lost in that world, and myself included. So I say this for myself, to remember to cultivate that internal world and tap into what it might be that matters to express and to share, to somehow contribute to this amazing human experiment that we're a part of. Because I do feel like I'm not a postmodernist in the sense that nothing matters or it's all kind of redundant. I do believe that we may be small in the universe, but it's our thing. It's our universe, according to us, because we matter too, even though we're tiny. And so we might as well make the best of it while we're here. And that means tapping into who we are and who our neighbors are, and how can we get along better, and how can we understand what it means to be here better.
Love it.
Cool.
Good question. Profound answer.
Good.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. For listeners, in the show notes, we'll include Emil's website where you can learn more about him and some of his work. Is there anywhere else, Emil, that you would direct people to if they wanted to learn more?
Primarily, I'm on Instagram. I have a lot of new content there. I also love photography, so it was sort of a natural app for me to start uploading things. So you can definitely see me there, just Emil Alzamora.
Great. All right. Thanks, Emil.
Oh, man. Thank you, guys. This has been great.
Thanks for listening to the Growth Equation Podcast. Learn more about our work and find show notes at our website, www.thegrowtheq.com. Follow us on Twitter at B. Stahlberg and at Steve Magnus. And if you like what you listen to, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast, as this goes a long way in helping it reach others.